Colonel French Blake, Reel 4.
Yes, the establishment, like the Viceroy and the Commander-in-Chief and the Resident and the local bigwigs, Maharajas and so on, all had books in the lodge, and when you arrived in the station, either for a long or short visit, you went and signed your name in the book. Just the same as if you go to Barbados to stay for a fortnight, you go and sign your name in the governor's book, and the odds are if he's got a garden party or anything, you might get asked to it. But if you don't sign your name in the book, nobody knows you're there. And our own officers in our own regiment, we went and called on them one by one as occasion arose, so that they would get to see us. And then after that, the invitations used to flow in, many as you wanted. A new face in the community is always worth anything.
Did you ever meet the Nizam?
No. He was very recluse, and very few people ever met him. He had fabulous stories about his palace, and that there were lorries full of gold which had been waiting to make their escape if the palace was raided, and they'd been standing there so long that the wheels had sunk up to the hubs in the courtyard and so on. I never knew how much of it was true. We used to meet his sons and his nephews and things. They used to appear at functions, but he was very seldom seen.
What impression did you get of the sons and nephews?
Oh, they were all right. I sold one of them. We got some tiger cubs, one shooting expedition. We came back with three cubs from the jungle, and we reared them for about 3 or 4 months until they got too large to manage. And we sold them to one of the Nizam's relations, who had a private zoo. And they used to play polo, and the young princes used to appear playing polo and so on.
Did you come across any famous civilians, like governors or the Viceroy or anything like
that? Oh, yes. Well, the Viceroy, one used to see quite a lot of, because one used to get asked to viceregal parties and things. They had Lord Linlithgow had children, you see, who were more or less contemporaries of our subalterns and had been at school with them. And they were a very bright lot indeed, and they used to have awfully good parties. They had a sort of nightclub downstairs in the Viceregal Palace in Delhi, where they used to give very amusing parties. And one met all the sort of great soldiers like Philip Chetwood and so on used to. You met them in the course of your duty, because they used to come and inspect the regiment, or and stay for the regiment, or dine with the regiment, or and so on. And there you go. Their business was to know everybody and everybody they knew. It wasn't so, the British Army wasn't so large in India.
Did you attend those parties that you mentioned?
Oh yes, you know, there were all sorts of this and that.
Did you have any special characters in the regiment?
Well, as far as officers concerned, there was one rather outstanding character. He was the second in command at the time. They were mechanized. He was senior major when I joined. He was called Gossage, and he was known as Sausage, needless to say, in the regiment. He really was an old-fashioned cavalry officer. He's a very fine horseman, and he'd won the Grand Military. He was rather keen on racing. He was a very thin, spare character, and he was a fanatical big game shot. He's more interested in big game, shooting panthers and tigers and things than anything else. Didn't play polo, he's keen on racing. But he was really a bit of a holy terror to the subalterns. He used to give his subalterns real proper stick. But he was also very artful and an extremely good soldier. Had he been a bit younger and mechanized, he would have undoubtedly made a really great armored commander, because he had a great tactical sense, and he also had a rather legal mind. He became, in fact, the sort of chief court martial president in Kenya during the war, and conducted all the court martials in Kenya, where he was known as the master in mutiny. But he had a very sharp tongue, with which he lashed out in all directions, and we were always very glad if we weren't in his squadron for that reason. But he was also very funny because he would, there was no respect of visiting celebrities. And I remember one guest night, we were dining outside, almost in the dark, because of the bugs and beetles which used to come on the table if we had too much light. And we had an extraordinarily boring man to dinner. I don't know what he was. He wasn't a soldier. He was some sort of civilian who was travelling around India and regaling us with his experiences in India. And he'd just been to one of the Maharajas who's got a palace on a lake, I think it's Bhopal, and he was describing how when they went along the lake, this motorboat, the fish by the vibrations of the water jumped out of the water all around the boat, you see. And then he said, and one of them jumped right over the boat, and a voice from the shadows where Gossage was sitting came, and I shot it with my fountain pen. But he used to take the management to pieces on the big exercises when they had a sort of post-mortem, and all the officers would be assembled in a vast marquee, and the umpires would say their piece and which side had done well and which side badly, and to the huge delight of his subalterns, who normally he was persecuting, he used to get up and take the generals and the brigadiers to pieces at these exercises afterwards. And he was a great character.
What were relations like with the men in India? Was there any difference in the quality of relationship with the men as compared to that in, say, in Britain?
Well, I never really soldiered in Britain before the war, because I joined in India and the regiment came home and then was mechanised. And, of course, there was a great change in relations rather than relationship when one was mechanised, because one was flung so much closer to the men, and you find yourself doing exactly the same jobs as they did in the tank and cooking the meals and sleeping, you know, four or five of you under the same blanket, more or less. And so that rather altered the rather more distant relations between officer and man, which maintained in the cavalry, where you, in those days, we weren't at war. On manoeuvres, we had an officer's mess, and there was a sergeant's mess, and then the soldiers ate out of sort of mess tins and sitting on the ground. The officers had a table and that sort of thing. All sorts of really rather ridiculous. But the regiment was a family, you see, and everyone was in it because they wanted to be in it, more or less. There were no pressed men, there were all volunteers in the army, and the regiment did its best to look after its own. And although there was a great disparity between the way the officers lived and the men lived, I don't think there was a great deal of envy. And there was no very little trouble. We had my regiment was really celebrated for court martials, because we hardly ever had a court martial. I think we had about three while I was in India. And we actually went through the war, the last war, without having anybody court martial, which was quite exceptional for any regiment. I think it's unheard of. And, you know, relations were very good. The soldiers respected the officers, and the officers respected the soldiers. I think, you know, we did different job. We did our jobs to our best, and I think anyone who does their job competently and gains respect, that's how discipline is maintained. And of course, the core of discipline in a regiment really is to have a fine middle piece of NCOs and warrant officers, and they were very good, and if you've got them, then no regiment is going to be in any difficulties whatever.
Did you have any problem with keeping the men from being bored?
Well, I suppose they were bored. I don't know how much we did about it, other than the normal army thing of organising a tremendous amount of competitive sport and competition of all sorts. There's not a lot of time to be bored if you keep a horse. If you try keeping one horse and see how much time you have to get bored, because by the time you've got up, fed it four times a day, ridden it, groomed it, cleaned its equipment, and your own. Today is pretty full. The rest of the day, you really just were quite content to spend on your bed sleeping. I think we did reasonably what should be done. There were no, I mean, boredom shows itself in crime, really, doesn't it? And then you get petty crime, and you get soldiers going off to the bazaar and looting or beating people up. I mean, there was a splendid mutiny in the infantry regiment, a British infantry regiment, in Jabalpur while we were there, and they burnt the barracks down and all sorts of things happened. You know, we never had anything happen like that. I think we were really rather too busy. The soldiers had plenty of opportunity for kind of sport, like going shooting and fishing, and so, if they wanted to do so. They hadn't got as good facilities as we had in the way of clubs and sailing and that sort of thing. But they had, in Skanderbeg, they had plenty of tennis courts, and they were very keen on cricket and football, which is the soldiers' real sport, and hockey. There was always something going on. There was quite good swimming and bathing and things for them. I don't know, honestly. I don't think there was a great problem. There was much more problem with the wives, which there hadn't been a good tradition for doing a lot for them. And certainly when they got out to India, they were really rather at a loose end not living a very happy life, because there weren't very many of them, and there was a very stiff class barrier, not between the wives of officers and the wives of other ranks, but between the wives of warrant officers and sergeants and corporals and soldiers' wives. And that was much, much more difficult to break down. And it was the officers' wives, in fact, who, and the wife of Lord Arthur Butler, who did most, really, to break down that whole sort of barrier and organise things for the wives and get the wives going, you know, as a whole. Nowadays, of course, it's totally different, because more soldiers are married in the army than aren't, and sort of first problem of everybody is what to do with the wives, you know, because they form now bulk enormously large in regimental administration, whereas in those days they weren't, people hadn't given it the same amount of thought.
Was sex a problem for the unmarried soldier in India?
Well, not really. It's much more a problem, especially the unmarried officer, because a soldier can always go off to whatever sort of brothel or anything that is. An officer really can't very well. The great funny thing was, the nannies, of course, were the great things. The nannies of the officers' wives and nannies. And one of the officers had an absolutely hideous old nanny. She was absolutely the ugliest thing in the world. And there's always a queue of potential swains for walking out of this nanny, queuing up outside the garden gate, waiting for her to come off duty. There was no problem for her anyway. I suppose it was a bit of a problem. I don't know. It's the sort of thing one doesn't really ask about.
What about with the troops? Did you take any special measures to prevent them using brothels?
Well, that really is a garrison affair, and of course the things were out of bounds. And there were very strict rules as where they could go and everything else. I don't think so. I don't think you can ever stop people going to a brothel. All you can do is to tell them what to do in order to not get VD and hope for the best after that. I've never known any out-of-bounds notice which ever stopped anybody going to a brothel if he wanted to go.
Was VD much of a problem in your regiment in India?
I was rather not sort of thing one wouldn't know the figures about, because the thing was rather sort of dealt with in regimental headquarters. I mean, there was a large-ish VD ward in the hospital, and every now and then some of one's soldiers found their way into it and out again. But, it wasn't I don't get any more problem then. It is now, well, there's probably less problem now. It's easier cured now. The cure was rather painful, I believe, in those days. And it was rather a good deterrent.
Did you ever take any leave back to England?
Oh, yes, yes, I did. One had, the officers were very well off for leave. Soldiers did 6 years in India and they didn't get home at all. And then after 6 years, they were entitled to a home posting. If they wanted to stay with the regiment, of course, they had to serve on. And they did, I think latterly, they did start getting leave for warrant officers and so on, could go home. But you got 2 months leave every year as of right, privilege leave, it was called. It was hardly worth coming back to England by ship on a 2 months leave because it took nearly a fortnight. And so a month of your leave was gone, spent on a liner, unless you were very fond of life on liners, which I'm not. You didn't get much value for your money. And so 2 months leave one would tend to take in the country or going to Kashmir or split it up into little bits and take a week here and a week there and so on. But every 3 years, I think it was, you got 6 months. And I did come home for my 6 months. In fact, I was thinking about leaving the army then and I spent a lot of the time wondering whether I wouldn't become a film director and then deciding not to.
Which stations did you prefer in India?
Well, I was only at two, it's Secunderabad and Meerut was infinitely the better of the two.
Why was that?
Well, Secunderabad had a tiresome climate. It was not very cold in the winter and not tremendously hot in the summer. Hot enough to be unpleasant in the summer, but not cold enough to be refreshing in the winter. And any length of time spent there, one was tended to get a thing called Deccan death. It was a kind of, it was allied with a thing called sandfly fever, which was caused by sandflies, which made you rather generally feel thoroughly run down and low-spirited. And then it was miles from anywhere, Secunderabad. There was no, what you might call, external social life. Nobody ever came to Secunderabad for anything. You only had the polo players that, and the people who actually lived in and around the cantonment. Bombay was the nearest. The polo was of such low standard there because there weren't enough good regiments playing that one's teams tending to go away from there had not only to make a very long journey, but when they got there found they weren't, you know, hadn't been playing nearly good enough stuff. And we never did much good for them. But Meerut, you see, was, first of all, it was 40 miles from Delhi. Only 40 miles from Delhi. It was a much better sporting country altogether. It was a much nicer climate because although the hot weather was stinking hot and really horrible, the rains were rather unpleasant, but the winter was lovely because it was bright and clear and almost a frost in the morning, not quite, but very nearly a frost in the morning, definitely a drip on the end of the nose, 6 o'clock in the morning. And a lovely, bright, like the best sort of English summer day in the daytime in the winter. But it was lovely. And you see, you were within sight. When you walked out, you could see the snow on the mountains to the north of you. And so you felt you were in sight of, you know, other better things. Where in the Deccan, you're in the middle of a vast, you know, sandy, rocky, granite plain stretching for miles and miles in every direction. And, of course, Meerut was the centre of the regimental polo. The inter-regimental was played there. And so once a year you had this marvellous Meerut week when all the regiments in India descended on you. And your houses were crammed to the brim with visiting regiments. And Delhi had a polo week as well. And, you know, everyone used to come and stay. And you always had visitors coming and going. And it was on the main line to Calcutta. We used to go to Calcutta for Christmas for the polo tournaments there. And very lovely sporting country too. Very good shooting, much better than Secunderabad. Very good snipe shooting, fishing not far away. You know, it was a sort of centre of, one of the sort of main social centres of India. And it was, as a station, was great fun.
Which hill station did you prefer?
Well, from Secunderabad, we went to Uttarakhand, which is a lovely place, marvelous, and it's a huge area, it's a huge plateau of grassy, it's like Salisbury Plain, which somebody has punched up the hills, like Salisbury Plain as it was before the war, and it was all grass, and somebody's punched up the hills till they're 2,000 and 3,000 feet high, and a lovely climate, just like the best English climate. In the hot weather, of course, that was. It was lovely. They grow, the hens laid full-sized eggs, there was strawberries and cream, English flowers, and it was trout fishing, you know. It was a beautiful place, fascinating place, a marvellous railway which took you up there with a sort of fantastic racks, steam engine. It was a gorgeous place, and wonderful big game also on the lower hills if you wanted it. The hill station from Meerut was a terrible place called Kailana. I suddenly remembered the name. And it was just a little... You went up and up and up, and eventually you came to a ridge, a sharp ridge, with a row of dreary sort of bungalows and huts and barracks and things perched along the top of it. And except for a fine view of the Himalayas to the north, there was absolutely nothing to do there. There was hardly room to even put a tennis court on it, because it was a sort of sharp pointed ridge. It was a thoroughly dreary place. I went to Simla just for a weekend to see what it was like, and it was rather fascinating, because it was straight out of Kipling. You know, Mrs. Hawksby is still riding around the streets in a rickshaw. And I went to Kashmir fishing. And that's a beautiful country, marvellous country.
Didn't you say that the at Uttarakhand they had an English-style hunt?
Oh, yes. The Uttarakhand hounds hunted the jackal before breakfast, because when the sun gets up and the dew's gone, there isn't any more scent. And all the Maharajas, Jaipur and Bhopal, Mysore, they all had sort of villas down there. They used to go down in the summer and hunt, and we used to send troop horses down. Troops were actually accommodated at Wellington, which is not quite on the top of the plateau. It's about a few miles down the hill. And it's a very beautiful place, all lots of mimosa trees growing. And we used to share a barracks there with the Somerset Light Infantry. It's very fine because they marched, as you know, at 120 to the minute. And cavalrymen only marched at about 101 to the minute. And so the parades were always very comical, with the light infantry marching with their band at 120, followed with our band trying to outblow them, and marching much slower, and going the same speed over the ground, actually. And there was this very good hunt. It was to hunt the jackal up and down these terrifying slopes, very, very steep, with bogs at the bottom. And used to go hurtling down until the horses got used to it. They used to run away down the hill. In fact, I got on a horse and it ran away down the hill with me, and it went past the governor of Madras, who was hunting. He was a rather fat, sort of Jorrocks-like figure. And as I went by, my knee caught behind his, and I swept him out of the saddle right up under the neck of his horse. I left him. My horse went down, eventually stopped when it got stuck in the bog at the bottom. The governor was heard to declare, "That young man doesn't appear to be very well in control."
You told me a nice story about how the master of the hunt lost his teeth.
Oh, yes. There's a splendid character called Dennison, Colonel Slock Dennison. Slock is a Cornish word, actually, meaning to lead. I don't know if that's how you slock a pig. Cornish say you slock a pig rather than driven. It means lead it, you know. And he was always known as Slock Dennison. I suppose he was always in front of what was going on. He's a splendid old character, and he went up to Sorgha to judge in the horse show, and he was put in an empty quarter for the night, and he took his false teeth out and put them on the table by the bed. And he woke up in the middle of the night in the bright moonlight, and he heard a scuffling, rattling sound just in time to see a rat making off across the floor with his false teeth in his mouth, and he disappeared down a hole in the floor. They took the boards up and they never found false teeth, so he had to go all through the show next day without opening his mouth.
You told me a bit earlier about your Indian servants. How did you find their work and find them generally?
Well, they were very, very good, if they were very good, and very bad if they were very bad. I had a camel from the south as my bearer, and he was stayed with all through Secunderabad. We got on very well together. He was very good. And when we got to Meerut, we had a terrible row. I think he got into debt. They all got into the hands of the Bunya, the banker, and got into debt. And quite a number of things of mine, my gold, a gold ring and some gold studs and, well, no, all my little bits and pieces disappeared. And I made an awful fuss about it. And then about 3 days later, he said he'd found some of them under the carpet, under the edge of the carpet. And I knew perfectly well he'd pinched them himself. And I didn't know why. I couldn't find out. I tried to find out, you know, whether he was in trouble or whether he was dead. And I gave him the sack. And I thought, no, you know, I can't go on with this. And so he left. And I got another man. It was absolutely terrible. I mean, you know, you had somebody for 3 years looking after you all the time. They know exactly what you want and when you want it. And you have a new man. And the first thing that happened, we were going to play polo. And I put on my clothes to change. And I went out to the car to get in and go off the polo ground. And there was this man standing on the veranda with an enormous glass of neat gin, which he handed to me. So I said,